So the uninspiring title of this talk is Monte Carlos and How to Improve Them. I hope to actually give you some slightly more inspiring notions, partly because I think I see a way to improve them that really involves a deep way of, to me, of looking at QCD in another way and actually of solving QCD in a slightly different way than we're used to. But I have to start with the basics and we'll see how far we get. It's all based on universality of the singular structures in gauge theory. So we all know those singularities are there, and usually we try to avoid them because we're thinking in the context of Feynman diagrams that have infinities when partons become soft or collinear, and we know that those are regions we should stay away from. So I'm going to go deep into those regions, and those are the regions I love. Those are the regions where partons go on shell. They can propagate from one end of the universe to the other end of the universe, and there's an infinite matrix element for that to happen. It's where they really want to be classical. They're trying to tell you that this is a classical field made up of infinitely many quanta, but you only did one quantum order of expansion, so it's trying to, with that one quantum, to tell you that there's a lot of them, actually. And that's what parton showers and Monte Carlos are trying to describe for you. And correspondence is really going to be a key property of what I'll talk about. I don't know if you know Yuri Dokshitsa, but sometimes he talks about klagons and quagons. I still haven't quite worked out what he's on about, but I see it reflected here also that most of the gluons that I'll be talking about, I think he would call klagons, classical gluons. They're really just a quantum representation of a classical gluon field, a charge that zips by you and you see a pulse of radiation, and that's what we're describing. That kind of pulse of radiation, synchrotron radiation, if you will. But then you also want to have the right quantum limits. So in fixed order perturbation theory, the whole problem that you have is that correspondence is kind of broken. You cannot go to the classical limit. You get infinities, and you would have to do an infinite order calculation in order to recover the classical limit. So we'll try to get the quantum and the classical behavior in one calculation. So the aim of all this, now this is where people would show a lot of LHC plots and say, oh, we need precision to extract this, to do that. For me, the aim is clarity. I really want to be able to view the TEV scale, whatever we see, whatever is there, with as high precision as possible, with as clear tools as we possibly can. And it bothers me that there are ways of solving QCD that, by summing inclusively over stuff, are able to reach higher precision than what we can reach with the ways of solving QCD that we have, where I'm able to address every pion. I would like a calculation in which, if I sum over all of those pions, I should be able to recover the highest precision that I'm able to get on any inclusive calculation. That's a mathematical problem. It's one we should solve. It's perturbation theory. It does not require solving confinement. It is something that should be a solvable, tractable mathematical problem. And it's one we should require of our solutions, I think. That also illustrates a lot of the structure of QCD. There's all this beautiful fractal structure, jets within jets, and almost conformal stuff in QCD that's beautiful to look at. And it's revealed by this type of calculation. Of course, that also allows us to use this calculation if we implement it as a tool and give it to our friends and so forth to extract masses, couplings of whatever they measure in reliable ways. You probably know of the example of the top mass that we don't really know what they're measuring. We know that they're measuring P mass of 6,1 in Pythia, but we don't know what that parameter really means. And if you had a more reliable matching to higher order solutions of QCD, you would know what those things meant, at least at some loop level. So what you really want are complete descriptions of collider physics down to every single pion, where if you're not interested in every single pion, you can sum over them and recover a high precision with robustness. And you want to have, when we go into the next run of the LHC, let's say a complete solution to QCD, which I don't mean all orders and non-perturbative, but down to something like the few percent level, which is what's relevant for collider physics. You want a solution that you can hand to the LHC experimentalists that will really allow them to do their work without worrying too much about theoretical uncertainties. So in that case, you know, now we're all scared that they're using Monte Carlos like black boxes. But if I knew that anything they could possibly do with it, it would have a very high precision, and maybe it would even be able to tell me what precision it thinks it has in a reliable way, then I wouldn't be so scared. And they could come back to me and say, actually, this precision is starting to hurt us now.
It's a question the way you're thinking about it. So We just speculate, like, why can't we just do calculations in terms of final states of E plus E minus in terms of just down to the single pions? But the usual understanding of that is that you have to get up to the lambda QCD scale. It's not what you're actually fundamentally producing in terms of partonically, so
right.
Conceptually I'm just confused about what you're saying when you want to have like single pion production in a non-inclusive way calculable.
So I may be able to tell you better what I mean by that when we get further. I'm not going to truncate in a fixed order of the coupling. I'm going to truncate in something else, and that will allow me to match onto a theory of pions.
You're not trying to do single pion production.
I don't think you're going.
Well, occasionally I would, very rarely. But in this talk, I was planning to talk mostly about perturbation theory and how to arrange these perturbative solutions within the context of a precisely defined phase space region in which I'm allowed to do perturbation theory. And then I can match that onto a non-perturbative model, so-called hadronization model. I wasn't going to describe those here, but occasionally they will describe a single pion. But if all I need to know about that hadronization model, whatever it is that it generates power corrections in lambda QCD. So if I know that whatever hadronization model I'm going to tack on generates power corrections, then I know something about the largest possible correction that I can get to the partonic final state that I have. So perturbation theory has done its job, and then I can start asking. That's ultimately also an aim of this. If I have a very highly precise perturbative calculation, then I can also use that to probe the non-perturbative physics better. I'll define a calculation, let's say, of jets. Partons. I'll use partons as stand-ins for jets, but I'll use a very low cutoff scale. So I'll produce some partons at some high, let's say PT scale or Q or whatever, some resolution scale that will evolve. So I will have, and it doesn't matter what this tree looks like, that's just a representation of many quantum paths that ultimately will interfere, and I will allow them to interfere. So don't take this too literally. At each scale here, I am inclusively summing over everything that that parton could do. So when I reach a scale of order 1 GeV, I'm still inclusively summing over anything those partons could do below 1 GeV, i.e. hadronization. I'm still summing over all of the pions inclusively. If I had an experimental final state, I would have clustered my pions into little jets that each would be of order 1 GeV. That's the framework of the perturbative calculation that I'll do. So you could take an experimental final state composed of pions and cluster it in that way if you want. I'm not sure I understand what the confusion is.
Well, yeah, I think it's just the way you said it, a single pion production.
Occasionally you will have a final state that makes up of two pions, but that is extremely suppressed. But that would be if I had, occasionally I would have a parton that would not shower at all. There would be no gluon radiation. There would just be single pions coming into single partons. But now partons that are resolved at very tiny energy scales, not a parton where I'm summing over everything inclusively, but where I've actually calculated an exclusive cross section for two and only two partons.
What I'm saying is that the conversion of this thing to one pion is principally not calculable. Yeah.
Its conversion to 10 pions is not calculable either.
Right. But there you win by.
Well, there is a perturbative part of this question and a non-perturbative part. So I will say I'll take a parton with a very high energy scale resolution, where I've summed over, it could have a hard jet or it could not have a hard jet. When I just produce two partons at leading order, I don't know whether there was a third jet or not. What I'm saying is I'll calculate now the exclusive cross-section for two and only two partons at the hadronization scale. I know that there are no transverse fluctuations in that system of scales greater than 1 GeV. That already tells me a lot. That system has a much higher probability to hadronize into two pions. It's still not going to happen that often, but it has a much higher probability of doing it than a system where I have many, many jets already at the perturbative level. So there is an interplay between these things. But we can discuss hadronization perhaps separately, because I would like to go the perturbative. I don't think we're going to get past the perturbative stuff in this talk. But ultimately, we want to look at the non-perturbative stuff as well. So down to each pion. It doesn't mean that there can't be more than one. Occasionally there will be one, and I want to describe that case too. But that will be a job where the hadronization model is really getting tested.
It's just the way you said it. You really are talking about an inclusive thing, and then you're talking about a particular final state. Your technology is inclusive.
Any perturbative calculation that you ever do will be inclusive, because you cannot represent the hadronization. So for me, that's a tautology. I wouldn't even say it that way. When I talk about two and only two jets, that's an exclusive cross-section, but I still have to define what scale those jets are at. So I will convert inclusive cross-sections to exclusive ones, but that doesn't mean that I'm still not inclusively summing over some low-scale phenomena. Okay, so I'll go a little bit into universality and singularities, which everyone knows, and then try to use that to build up an infinite order approximation QCD, and show also how that relates to classical processes, which are very simple, and that's actually how the generators are constructed. And then start wondering about how can we now take this approximation to all orders QCD and improve it. And I'll show what people are doing now, and which I think is fitting square pegs in round holes. And I'll try to show you something more beautiful that also works better, as far as I can tell. But we haven't done it for all cases yet, so we don't know if it's going to work. But it looks nice. Okay, so singularities. Let's say we had some Higgs production, and we produced a couple of photons. Now, in this kind of process, we've summed over everything that could happen at lower scales here. We've done a factorization. And so actually, let's say that in this event, we had actually this topology that created. And I'll label these partons just for fun. So I've just looked at one of the sides here. This is a particular branching history of that particular final state. And this may or may not be observable jets in the final state. But it's just one particular quantum correction among infinitely many that I'll have to calculate. And we already know many properties of this stuff. Most Bremsstrahlung is emitted by partons that are almost on shell. It's again just the classical problem of accelerating a charge, and you will see it radiate. So it's not a particularly quantum phenomena, but we do see it reflected in gauge theories, in our diagrams here, by the propagator factors that we have. So these partons that emit other partons will want to go on shell, and we have singularities whenever they do. So in particular, there are two that are relevant. One is just the limit in which these two partons become collinear. So this propagator goes on shell. That gives you a familiar. This way. You just combine these. So these are on-shell matrix elements. When A and B are exactly collinear, you can add them up, and there's no invariant mass. They're both on-shell matrix elements, and they factorize into this form. And these are the Alzarelli-Parisi splitting kernels, which, if you know them, fine. If you don't know them, don't worry. They're just universal expressions. You always find the same. They're just governed by propagator structures here, with a little bit of numerator stuff that depends on whether you have gluons splitting to gluons or quarks splitting to quarks plus gluons. But it doesn't really matter. It's just what matters is that I can do this for any process. In particular, I can do it several times, and so on and so forth. There's also another singularity which is important, which I tried to indicate here, which is actually arising from the interference of this gluon being emitted from here and emitted from there. So it involves that parton becoming on shell and that parton becoming on shell at the same time. So these two, sort of color ordered, emitting a soft gluon together. And there we get the so-called iconal factor, which is just this. And again, that's a completely universal factor that you find everywhere. And then, well, this is actually, I don't like this way. I like it this way. have just dot product with momenta. This is the eichenal factor, or the dipole factor. And then I have all these momenta with just taking k out. And again, since k in this limit is having zero energy, it doesn't matter if I take it out. I still have an on-shell matrix element here, an on-shell physical matrix element here. And then I have this factor that's, again, that's universal. And you can even generalize it to higher numbers of partons. So these are really the singularities that drive most of the Bremsstrahlung. This is what I would want, a parton shower or some such object, to just resum that kind of emission to all orders so that I could build up a structure here that would reflect, basically would give you a quantum representation of the classical Bremsstrahlung field, where each of these individual quanta are now representative of the Bremsstrahlung field that you will see on average stochastically from these accelerated charges.
It's not quite quantum, no, because you are combining probabilities here. You have squared matrix elements.
Sure, so sure. Yes, so this is already, yes.
Large N, some sense.
There's a couple of things happening here, yes. So in the collinear limit, I'm saying, well, this propagator going on shell, the diagram with that in it, is going to dominate over any other Feynman diagrams. I can neglect all interferences and everything else. For the collinear directions, it really is only this singularity that matters. That's also what the C part of SCET is based on. For the soft singularity, what I'm doing here is I'm taking a leading NC approximation. I'm saying I have a color-ordered amplitude, where I don't have to worry about whether there's some other parton pair here that could be red anti-red, and maybe this is red anti-red before it emitted, and now it's green like this, so it was a red anti-red, and maybe these would interfere. That's subleading in color. So I'm going to neglect that. I'm going to say that's suppressed by 1 over NC squared. Doesn't happen very often. It could happen, but doesn't happen at leading NC. So all I have to worry about if I want to see a red anti-red dipole emit a soft gluon, that's a little antenna right there. And it's the only antenna in the universe that's red and anti-red, because all the other ones have different colors, different charges. So I only have to worry about this particular antenna emitting that soft gluon, which works up to 1 over NC squared. Then one would have to do better. So there's a bunch of interference effects here which are not included. That's why it's semi-classical. But I am talking about individual partons with individual momenta, so it's quantum as well. That's what I mean. I've quantized the field. I'm representing it as individual quanta. What you could also think about just in having a description of gluon radiation, but that would be sort of difficult to hadronize and stuff.
It's clear a bunch of the interference is neglected, but is what interference is included, the way you said it?
The interference between this part, that's the dipole interference, if you will. That's what leads to angular ordering. In normal cascades, if you want to really reproduce this factor and you start from Dirac functions or some such thing, if these partons a priori don't know about each other, if you're not using dipole functions, then the way to tell them about each other is to cut them in half here, where the angle, using the angle that separates them. And that's where the notions of coherence, QCD, angular ordering, comes from. I'm not going to use that. I'm just going to use these functions as they are. So I'm not going to need angular ordering or anything like that. But that's coherence of this red and anti-red charge. If they're going like that over there, a large wavelength gluon here is not going to resolve them. So there will be destructive interference outside this cone of radiation there. Basically, this little dipole is boosted. So most of the radiation from the dipole, which in its center of mass would be a symmetric function, because this dipole in this frame is boosted, will be going in that direction, and there won't be very much radiation going outside. That's called coherence. And in parton-based showers, you do that with angular ordering. But in dipole-based showers, you have this form, just because you're using the right antenna function to start with. You don't need angular ordering in that case. Okay, so there are interferences between these two taken into account. But that's it. At this level, that's all the interference you get. Not very much, but very important. Otherwise, you would screw up the singularities. So at this point, I only have a structure It's guaranteed to reproduce the leading singularities, not even at 1 over n squared, but leading n singularities. I can also do the 1 over n ones. I can include U1's leading to QQ bar in the collinear framework. So I can get 1 over n, but not 1 over n squared. I can do some 1 over n squared by using CF and CA judiciously and so forth, but let's not go into that.
There's also some leading log type of.
Yes, exactly. But I didn't integrate anything yet, so I don't have any logs yet. I just wanted to say that using this and iterating it, I can do another thing. It's another clever thing that I have to do. I can build in scale violation. This could be a conformal tree. This could be n equals 4 or something like that, where the coupling didn't run. I think of it as QCD at frozen coupling. And this would just be a description of jets within jets within jets, quantum fluctuations within fluctuations within fluctuations. You would have this beautiful fractal scale invariant picture. Of course, that's not QCD. So the trivial way of building in scale violation into this is by replacing the coupling by the running coupling. And you can then, for each of these vertices, you can put in a different scale. And since they don't interfere with each other, you're not doing anything wrong. And you can show from resummation arguments that it's alpha s of pt squared, basically, that you have to use here to get the right answer. I show you that explicitly if I get around to, because we've computed the corrections, the next leading order corrections if you use other scales. And you can see that some choices, pt, are stable. If you use other choices, you have logarithmic corrections somewhere. So you can build in scaling violation into this tree. So you have a fractal that kind of evolves as you look at it. I think that's the way you should look at QCD. And then, as far as I'm concerned, there are a couple of quantum corrections and some interferences that I would like to build into the structure because it's not so good. But it does generate the vast amount of structure and infinite order perturbation theory that you can then start to... You have a very good starting point. That would be my argument. Right, so I can nest these factorizations. This has n partons, this has n plus 1. I can do it again. I can get n plus 2, n plus 3, n plus 4. I can build up infinite tree-level amplitudes, amplitude squared. Some of these factorizations can even be applied at the amplitude level. But we don't do that in the parton showers or stochastic probabilistic, so we use it. Matrix elements. Right. But that's not very helpful, because again, this is all very singular, and what am I going to do with a bunch of singular matrix elements? And in the regions where they're not singular, I know that I can't trust them, because I only know that I'm getting their singularities right. I don't know that I'm getting any of the non-singular terms that real quantum mechanics or quantum field theory would produce right. So it seems like I've constructed something utterly useless. It has all the right singularities, but in the singular regions, I can't calculate. It's not quite that bad, because we know, because there's one more property that is intrinsic to this, which is unitarity. So I know something about what the singularities are going to have to happen when I start calculating loop corrections to this. I know that the probability for a parton to propagate from one end of the universe to the other on shell and then emit a soft parton can at most be 1. It can't be infinite. And that's encapsulated, for e plus e minus at least, in the Kinoshita-Lee-Naundorff theorem, which basically says, at each order, the loop correction has to be equal to minus the integral of the tree at the same order in alpha s, plus some non-singular piece. So in the context of parton showers, we call this relation unitarity. So when I use the word unitarity, watch out. I use it to mean that I set the loop and the tree to be exactly equal with an opposite sign, and I'll neglect this piece. This is what you get from the so-called leading log approximation. Since we don't know, I haven't calculated the actual quantum scattering for this process. I don't know what the finite piece is. So I could play games with setting it. I could vary it if I wanted, and we actually want to do that for uncertainty estimates. Gives you a complementary way of estimating uncertainties apart from alpha s variations. But before I do that, when I'm just constructing this infinite order approximation, I can do leading logs. So can I write something down that ensures this, that really has this built in from day one, unitarity, that I would then have to be very explicit about violating if I wanted to get n and k factors and other things, for instance. And there is a way of doing that. If you think of a classical stochastic process, so So really what I was aiming for was I wanted this system where I had summed over a lot of things. I just wanted to generate an explicit history for it, an explicit representation of the jets within jets for that particular event, stochastically. So I'm actually thinking in terms of an evolution. And we know in QCD we have evolution equations. I can start with a set of partons either in the initial or final state. Mostly in this talk I'll talk about final because it's easier. I don't have to deal with PDFs. And I can think of an evolution equation, the number of final states that evolve as a function of some resolution variable. So t can be log dt squared or log mass squared or some other resolution variable that you like. It can be thrust, it can be whatever you want in principle, but some measure of the resolution scale of the system, an effective factorization scale, if you will. As I evolve it, it should produce f plus 1 states at this rate. Right. Then if I start with some number of events that represent f final states, as I evolve in t, they will generate the cross-section for f plus 1 in exactly the right way. This would be an exact relation. Again, I'm going to put approximations here. I'm going to put the leading log, or the singular approximations to this guy, and we'll see that this structure will generate that approximation. So this is a very simple equation. We know it very well from a different quantum, but process that we can treat classically, which is just nuclear decay. So this equation is exactly the same as the equation for nuclear decay. And now I can apply perturbation theory to it if I want. I can do something stupid, which is the same stupid mistake that you do in nuclear decay the first time, the teachers like to illustrate, which is to forget about the time dependence of this guy and just say, well, I'm solving a linear equation here, so the NF at the time t will be N0 and 1 minus, and in nuclear decay, this is just the decay constant, right? Minus C times N minus CT. At early times, that works very well. So I start with some number of evolvers, some number of QQ bar states or whatever that I've plucked from the vacuum, or some number of nuclei, and they start evolving. But at some point, at large times, I see I'll get crazy answers from this kind of solution. I'll get negative values, kind of the same things that we actually see coming out of perturbation theory when we apply it in the wrong regions. And the solution is, of course, that this does have a time dependence. And so the correct solution, we all know, is the exponential one. And now I will just write it with the correct thing instead, because this, in nuclear decay, that the decay probability doesn't have time dependence, but this does depend on the scale. In particular, it has all these singularities as I get to long distance scale. So it has a very significant time dependence. So let's still just call it dt. I haven't specified what I'm evolving in yet. So this is really, if you will, one way of illustrating the origin of the exponential, that you're thinking in terms of a classical process in which you have a system of evolvers that you want to satisfy a certain differential equation, a certain evolution equation, and this then leads to the exponential form if you want to keep track of the fact that every QQ bar pair that emits a gluon no longer exists as a QQ bar pair. It is now a QG Q bar state. So you've generated a new state similar to a nucleus that decays to two daughter nuclei, and they can then continue to evolve. So every time I have a QQ bar pair that emits a gluon, I will have to remove that QQ bar pair and introduce a QG and a GQ bar dipole. And they can then continue to evolve in time.
So just to get back to your example for QCD of frozen coupling, that would be conformal, then this factor would not depend on the resolution.
It does depend on the resolution, because it still has these, still has the singularities. But the solutions would have very pretty properties. So I would still have an interesting integral to do here.
It would not look exactly like nuclear decay.
They would still not look exactly like nuclear decay. Well, They would look pretty close to nuclear decay, but you would have to do a little more maths to get there. You don't just have a C. Actually, the parton shower evolution equations that I write are based on conformal solutions. And then there is a metric redefinition that you can do that absorbs the scale violation, and then it looks just like a scale invariant solution, but it has scale violation in it, and you just do a Jacobian trend. That's a very beautiful trick. If you neglect the rolling of the coupling, you get very simple equations here that you can generate random numbers according to, and you can generate these trees. Most of the Monte Carlos, you can ask to do that if you want. And then actually absorbing the scale violation is actually quite simple in this case. Okay. Let's see, that was nuclear decay. So, right, so this thing, NF of t, how many are remaining at some time t, QQ bar pairs or whatever, divided by how many I had at t equals 0, we call that the Sudarkov factor. So that would be a function of two scales. You evolve a parton system from some starting time to an ending time, and you say, well, what's the probability that it remains undecayed, i.e. that it did not emit any gluons or so? It's equivalent to the fraction of nuclei remaining at some time t, and it has that exponential form. Now, you can also see another. So, okay, the first term in this expansion is just the stupid one that you had to start with, but there will be higher order corrections. So this will generate terms with negative signs that look just like virtual corrections. And that's exactly what this factor embodies. It embodies the virtual corrections. So from this, I can build up trees. And for each parton line, I will have now evolution factors from this scale to that scale, from that scale to that scale, because I'm generating the radiation using this differential equation. So that will build up if that parton survived from this scale to that scale. Then automatically the probability comes associated with the probability for that parton to survive from the starting scale to the NCL. So now I'm generating some higher order corrections that are loop-induced, and because, again, of the differential equation here, the differential of this, I have exactly the tree-level splitting probability in the exponent. So that will come out, that will be exactly what comes out in the expansion. So the tree level, this is the integral of the tree. That is exactly what I'll get as my first loop correction. And so this, the fact that these are related by differentiating each other, means that I have exact unitarity in this sense of the tree being equal to the loop, minus the loop.
Sorry, it's probably a stupid question, but in this differential equation, so there's the lost term here, obviously, you have a splitting, and you don't have the same final state anymore, but why is there no gain term? Did you start with some NF minus 1 that splits and that produces this NF?
I'm always thinking in the context of starting from the lowest number of partons. In this case, from the Born. So I have two partons, and there are no systems with fewer partons than that. So there's no gain term in this case. Then, as this emits a gluon, I just do that with this equation here. That already represented the gain term. So if I wanted to calculate the three jet rate, then I would have a gain term and a loss term. Right, so maybe that's what you're asking.
You follow each of the final partons again, and you ask.
Right. What is the probability for that parton now to remain undecayed? So if I wanted to convert this into a calculation of, let's say, the exclusive three jet rate, which I have over here, then I would have both gain and loss terms. But in principle, a parton can only disappear. In the way that I'm ordering it.
Are you using the Kalin theorem, or you're just saying this is consistent with the Kalin theorem?
I want an evolution equation that is consistent with the Kalin theorem.
Because it seemed, just thinking about that theorem as far as I remember it, I think it's kind of, the way it's proven is a little inconsistent with your assumptions, but if it's just you just saying it's...
No, well, this is more general than just the singular structure, right? Because it says that there can be a finite remainder. What I have said here is just lives up to this theorem. I mean, the only reason I can do it is because this theorem exists. If this wasn't true, I don't even know what quantum field theory would mean anymore.
That's the point, right? You're neglecting some interference effects, and it's not really quantum field theory that you're doing. That's what I'm saying.
No, as I said, most of these gluons are Clagons, classical gluons that represent Bremsstrahlung. Okay. And then I have some of these coherence interference effects in there, which is an interference effect. But you would get the same thing from a dipole picture in QED. Or not QED, just ED. But we'll see how to build in the quantum effects. I just wanted to show you what this looked like first and what the basis of it is. That we have these very strong conditions of unitarity. There's an exponential expansion that gives you your approximation to the loop corrections. Actually, loop plus unresolved, because these are finite. They have logarithms, but they're finite. Just so you see where all this... And now, of course, when I start to do this expansion, I want to put this guy back. But that is much less work than trying to do a much bigger work that I will show you briefly how people do. Try to get fixed order and showers to talk together now in very square peg round hole kinds of ways that take a lot of time and inefficiency, and it doesn't really represent what QCD does. So I start from the, you can say, if you want a very accurate calculation that includes showering, you could start from the fixed order perspective and say, well, I have some matrix elements that I can calculate in quantum field theory. And I know that up to the given order that I calculate them, they include all interference effects. And so they're rigorous calculations up to that order. And then I want to shower them. But then we have this issue of double counting that I'll get to if you do that, that you have to get rid of. And then, okay, I can define some cuts and various things, and I can try to, that's the square peg round hole. And I can jam them together, yes. And if I do it carefully, I might not even be doing something wrong. But the starting point that I want to take is that most of the structure is actually classical. So I want to start from saying, well, I have an infinite order calculation already, which approximates every single coefficient in the perturbative series. And in the region that are dominant, where most of the radiation occurs, this calculation is correct, because most of the radiation is driven by leading logs. But there are regions, and important regions, in which it is not correct. So I want to basically look at it from the opposite point of view, saying that you start from the shower calculation, and now I want to use the amplitudes that I can compute in some fixed order expansion to correct that structure. So start from a quasi-conformal tree loop thing, and then I want to use amplitudes to improve it up to some given order, or even continuing to infinite order. So I wanted to show you this first, because anyway, that's what, you know how to compute fixed order amplitudes, but you might not know exactly how this structure looks. Well, those of you who are familiar with resumation know it very well. Right. I could show you how you recover fixed order expansions from these kind of exponentiated expressions. There are simple mathematical tricks that you can say, the emission of one gluon, now I've put all these Sudakov factors on it, but this then says, well, if it's the first emission, what's the probability? So normally I would have, let's say, the sigma f plus 1, d sigma, is some phase space times a matrix element. In the, how would I generate that, even if I had the exact expression driving my evolution algorithm? I would not get exactly this. I would get, get the same thing here if I'm careful about how I do phase space, which is another ambiguity. If I had the correct expression in the evolution equation here, if I really used the correct matrix element with the correct finite terms, not just the singular piece, I could even get to this. But I would still have these Sudakov factors sitting here. That would be the f plus 1 at some scale q. and this would be the Surikov factor that took me down to Q. That would be the probability that this emission was the first that happened. But the emission could also have been, I mean, at some PT, there will also be an emission where that was the second to happen, or the third to happen, or the fourth, or whatever. And in order to recover this expression, which is an inclusive quantity, I can sum over whether it was the first, the second, the third, or whatever to happen, and then I will recover this. So that's just to say that when you calculate these probabilities, or these matrix elements in fixed order QCD, they are really a multiplicity times a cross section. If this is bigger than the Born, then the ratio tells you, on average, how many of those emissions would you have, and that's also encoded in these formulae. So you can actually show mathematically that if you sum over whether this is the first, second, third, or whatever, you get exactly this, with no higher order remnants back, which is the beautiful result, actually. But I would like to move on, so I think I won't show that. Okay, so let's see where we got. I'll kill this one. So it's popular to represent the perturbative series as a bunch of boxes where you have legs going one way and loops going the other way. And what we've done so far is we've started with a Born that we calculated exactly, where we have legs plus 0, plus 1, plus 2, and it goes on, loops, plus 1, plus 2, whatever. And then we actually generated the entire rest of the perturbative series by bootstrapping. Not the entire series, the leading log approximation to it. We could go this way using universality of the singularities. I can always add an on-shell propagator, and I know exactly what term to associate with that, and it splits into two. Now I've increased the final state multiplicity by one, and I know that it was either a soft or collinear splitting, and I know how to do that, so I can keep on going. I also saw how I can use unitarity in the sense that I defined unitarity, to go like this. So the integral of this singularity has to be equal and opposite to that singularity. And now I can keep playing that game and do things like this. And I also didn't really prove it, but I showed you at least the idea of exponentiation, which I can use to go from the Born. I can attach a Surikov factor is supposed to resum all the possible virtual corrections to that coefficient. So I can also go straight up. So from these very important rules, I can generate the entire perturbative series in a certain approximation, in a bootstrapping way, where I can actually, if I've done this carefully, work out what every single coefficient I calculate is. And that's the trick. You have to do it in a calculable way. The old shower codes from the 70s and 80s and so forth were not designed to have tractable expansions. They very quickly get very complicated because of their phase space maps. They don't fill all of phase space. You have to do all kinds of tricks. So beyond a few orders, it becomes almost impossible to work out analytically what they do. Because now, of course, what I'm thinking about is that, well, I know perturbatively how to compute this. I also know exactly what the shower expansion is for that coefficient. I can work out a correction. I can put it back in, and I can keep on going. And that's the way that we're now doing it. Because we've now developed algorithms that have simple tractable expansions. At two loops, they start getting a little bit messy. But at one loop, they're still easy to deal with at arbitrary numbers of legs. We also saw that this whole skeleton that I built up depends on a number of things. It depends. I have splitting probabilities, these factors of GS, and I had to choose a renormalization scale for them. So they depend on the renormalization scale, just like any other calculation would. But they also have other dependencies. They depend on what I define time to be. What is the resolution scale in which I'm evolving? What's the d sigma dt? What is it, thrust? Is it invariant mass? Is it PT, some measure of different measures of PT? What is time? That will give you slightly different that basically classifies what is a late emission as to what is an early emission. And so if I have something here that prefers soft over collinear, I would have more soft emissions generated because I would never get to the collinear ones until much later. Or the other way around, right? So I have many possible definitions of what that is. There are the non-singular terms. I only know what the singular structure of this entire thing should be, the leading singular structure. I don't know what the non-singular and subleading terms in principle should be, so I can vary those. There's the phase space mappings. When I did this, I wrote that down a little quickly. But I have to define a prescription for how to add a parton with finite momenta. I wrote down these on-shell relations between matrix elements that had really exactly collinear partons or an exactly soft parton. What if it's not exactly soft? What if I'm in the finite region of phase space? I have to define a prescription that does that, that obeys the correct limiting. It has to have the right infrared limits, but there is an ambiguity, which can be interpreted as a global rotation angle for what to do outside. And ultimately, I have to have, I have to define an infrared cutoff. I'm not going to keep doing perturbation theory when I start getting too close to lambda QCD. And of course, my prediction, how many partons I have, what everything looks like, is going to depend a little bit on where I stop doing perturbative physics. And my hadronization model would then have to absorb small changes in that scale. But it is a property of the perturbative calculation. I have to say, where do I stop doing perturbative physics? So now,
is that doable? That you can really vary the scale of the hadronization model, and it's sort of you can check that it doesn't. I mean, obviously, what you say is logically an ideal world. It would
yes.
Work like that.
Right? You can work out some rules. They are not implemented anywhere that I'm aware of, including in Pythia. But there are some rules. If you look at the old papers of Bo Andersen, he worked out how the fragmentation function parameters have to scale when you change the parton shower cutoff. I don't think anyone paid attention to that, as far as I'm aware. But that is ultimately something that you would like to be there. So what people do today is they just brute force retune, right? If you change this, you have to retune the model, and that's what people do. If I make this a little higher, then the hadronization model has to do more. I have to increase its PTs and its fragmentation activity a little bit. And if I decrease it, then the perturbative calculation is doing more, so the hadronization model can do less. So I know what to expect, roughly. But you see that there's a bunch of dependencies here. They're all unphysical. Nature doesn't care what I call the resolution scale, or which terms I have or don't have, or how I partition phase space. But there's more here that I can vary than just the renormalization scale. I would argue that I can get more comprehensive uncertainty estimates from this calculation than I could from an ordinary fixed order calculation. I really vary all these terms, and we've defined a Monte Carlo called Vincia that does have the capability of varying all of these, and it gives you uncertainty bands. As it runs, it checks what would the probability have been for this event if I had used a different da-da-da-da-da-da, and it gives you a different weight for that event, depending on different assumptions that you make about what these things are. And then you can do matching. You can correct. Like if I really put in, now the expansion of the shower, the Sudakov factors and so forth, they're going to depend on what I choose. So if I can work out what the exact perturbative coefficient is, that will have the dependence on all these things. The fixed order expansion will not, and therefore I will have a cancellation. So I will start canceling the dependence on these choices, and that's exactly what I want to see. So let's do that. Now we go to the pink sheets.
Before you go on, I don't want to keep asking the same question in a different way, but your use of unitarity here is again the KLM, right? That's what you were saying, that was your...
Yes.
Okay, so...
I'm not talking about cuts.
Okay, good. So what I'm just a little confused about is kind of what I was saying before is That theorem is true in quantum field theory. You're neglecting a bunch of things to start with. You're throwing away a bunch of
things. We can call it probability conservation. Everything has to sum to one,
yes.
If you want. That is what unitarity expresses. So that's why I call it unitarity. But it really is just probability conservation. It's just that I have two quarks, and I don't suddenly have also two others. I cannot change the weight of that event. In this framework, when I integrate over everything, I will get exactly the leading order Born cross-section back. Nothing more, nothing less. That's not exactly what I want, of course, so now I want to start correcting it. But the structure that I've defined so far, probability is exactly conserved. If I define the integrated weight of the sample to be the leading order Born cross-section, that is what it will remain to be forever. And when I sum over everything, I'll get that back. Again, an inclusive probability that I recover from summing over everything. It's just probability conservation.
Is it right to call it a loop?
Is it right to call it a leg? I neither have actually explicit legs or explicit loops in here. I showed you some properties of leg diagrams, which have these singular structures, and I showed you some property of loop calculations, the KLN theorem.
Which is 1 minus the leg KLN.
Right. But I could have done it the other way. I could also have said, well, I know what the loop has to be. So that's how people derive splitting functions, right? They actually look at the loop expansions. I look at the tree-level matrix elements because it's easier for me to do that, the factorizations. I don't want it to be integrated. But you can do it either way. It really is a bidirectional arrow. So the fact that I'm going from here to there is not really significant. You could go the other way if you want it. But I don't have any really, well, legs, I have partons carrying momenta. I do have that, and then I have the Sudakov factors. But the Sudakov factors, they don't really represent, they represent unresolved real radiation plus loops in this approximation, unless you do other things, which I'll now start doing.
Well, one thing this gives you is a good parameterization of all the uncertainties.
I think so. I've introduced a bunch of other arbitrary parameters, and now I can vary them.
Isn't there another question of how to systematically improve?
Yes. So I will get there now. So, for instance, if I calculate the tree-level matrix elements, they know what these terms are. I don't, from just singularity, I don't. But if I actually calculate for this process, but the shower is powerful in the way that I can apply that to any process. The rules are general. It's universal. That's the power of showers, that you can take any process, right, and you can just, I showered it with Pythia. That works because the singularity structure is universal. If I want to start correcting things, I have to start saying, well, this is for that process and that's for that process, because the numerator terms depend on what process I'm talking about. So that's a more specific question, which I have to do process by process. But I can try to automate that, and which is what which is now the aim of the field.
Once you start to think about improvement, you will have to write into this function for that.
Absolutely.
The matrix elements, how do you put them in and the match them to?
Yes, and I sketched that over there, but I'll show you how that works. I just wanted to say that this is true for any shower calculation in principle. Normally, you can only vary that one, even in shower calculation. But we are now starting to develop frameworks where you can vary all of them. And then when I match to the actual matrix elements, I'll see the dependence on these things start to cancel.
What about the momentum reshuffling? If you have a particle that is then, which one of these is that going?
Phase-space factorization. Kinematics map, phase-space factorization, recoil strategy. Depending on who you are, you call it different things. But it has to do with how do you add the extra parton. Okay. We have not seen that. So this, I'll sketch what people are doing now, which works, and there's no reason you shouldn't use it, but I'll also say why I think it's a little bit ugly, and I think we can do better. So this is a sketch of a strategy called MLM or CKKW. Now, you start from a Born level process, a matrix element, and of course you have to compute first the Born level process. You know how many events to throw or how much weight to assign to each event. Then you have to generate events in the Born level
base pairs and attach weights to them. You shower those events. This is what you would normally do. This is what you would do if you used MapGraph or whatever. And the result of doing this is that your Born plus one cross section, for instance, as a function of some PT scale, PT of the extra jet, PT1, is now the leading log approximation, the leading log probability times your Born double cross section for this. So you just generated an approximation. But now let's say, well, this I don't want that approximation anymore. I actually know how to compute 1 plus 1. So now, OK, I have to compute 1 plus 1. And since it's fixed order, I have to apply some PT cut. Let's call that PT cut, above which I define this calculation. Because if I didn't, then I would run into all the singularities, and this would just give some meaningless infinity. So reasonably, I would say that I should pick this PT scale to be such that this is not much larger than that. I want a convergent fixed order expansion, so that this is some fraction of that. If this starts to be bigger than that, it's because I actually want to emit several of these. The ratio is the average number of such emissions I would have. And that would mean that I can't really trust fixed order if I have several. So this should never be bigger than a fraction of that. And then I have to generate these events. So now I'm adding calculations I have to do. I have to calculate this first, which is sometimes non-trivial. And I have to generate these events. This phase space is a little more complicated than that phase space. I have to shower these. And if I do that, now, of course, if I just add these two samples, I would be adding the approximation to the real answer, and I would double count all of the terms contained in here. So I'd get two times the cross-section that I wanted. Or not exactly two times, but I would double count all these terms if I just brutally added them. So this will give me sigma Born plus 1 of some PT if it's greater than PT cut is PLL times sigma Born plus F plus this finite term that actually is in the matrix element. But I don't want to just add these two things because I would have this term twice. So I want to get rid of that. And the way to do that is to say, well, if I start with a Born level event and I shower it, what is the probability for that event to not have any jets above this PT cutoff? Well, that's the Sudarkov factor. That's what the Sudarkov factor represents, the probability to not have any emissions. So I would like to somehow actually say that this is an inclusive cross-section for B plus anything. I want to translate this inclusive cross-section into an exclusive, semi-inclusive, or whatever Michael likes to call it, a more exclusive cross-section that has exactly zero jets above this scale. Then I know that there's no double counting, because any event that does have a jet above that scale, I'll treat it with this guy. Any event that does not have one, so I need to compute, I need to somehow translate this into the sigma Born times the Sudarkov factor of going down to PT cut with no emission. That will be a fraction of these events, so this cross-section will be reduced, but I'm going to add a bunch more events. So the cross-section will stabilize if I do everything consistently. The simplest way of, the methods differ in how you compute this Sudarkov factor. You can either say, well, analytical estimation, I know how to compute Sudarkov factors, exponentials, and I can just do the best calculation I can. Or you can say, actually, wait a minute, that's a little bit dangerous. We want to preserve unitarity. That is very important, probability conservation, as defined in the shower. So I want this Sudarkov factor to be what the actual shower would have generated. I want this to be related by differentials to the shower. So I'll compute it with the shower. I could say, well, let's just take all these events and shower them and throw away the ones that happen to have a jet above this PT scale. That will exactly count the Sudarkov factor, because those are the ones that had a jet. So you can do that too. And that's basically the difference between MLM. So MLM just uses the shower, showers the events, and then it computes the Sudarkov factor from that. And the original formulation of CKKW, they used analytically calculable. And then there are variants in between. And don't ask me which code implements what right now. It used to be that AlpGen would do MLM, MadGraph would do MLM, and Sherpa would do CKKW. To my knowledge, they are theoretically, the formal precision of them is equivalent. There's been a lot of debate about that. Some people don't agree. I cannot see that. I can see that you make mistakes in both. And that's also part of why I don't like them. We can discuss what the subtleties are. But I don't see that one mistake is worse than the other.
The computational time similar?
That may differ. I've only run Sherpa, actually. So I'll show you some speed comparisons with Sherpa. But there are certain things that you have to do. You have to compute these cross-sections. You have to generate this. You have to do the showers. And so there are certain things that will always take the same time. Now, if you implement it algorithmically more or less efficiently, maybe you can do faster or slower. I've compared to Sherpa what we do. In Sherpa, I see a certain scaling on a log plot. Maybe you can change the slope of that line a little bit, depending on what you do. But you can't change, so I'll show you that you can get something that's much more like a flat line that does not depend on the multiplicity, for instance. So there are differences here in how the codes implement that. But this is really the essence, right? You want to say, well, I'm guessing when this emits a hard jet, I'm using the shower to guess at what that hard jet rate should be. I'll just reject that event. That's not the event I want. I want this one instead. That's really to do with how these are inclusive. And then you calculate something that's more like an exclusive cross-section. Zero jets. This will populate the zero jet bin if you use this as your jet definition. Of course, if that's not exactly your jet definition, there'll be some mixing between the bins, right? But this also then puts what it looks like what the shower would have done. But it is exactly what the shower would have done. You have to do that over here as well. So let's just illustrate what happens when you do two legs. Do the same. And here you would reject still. So here you say reject if PT, if any PT greater than PT cost. Same thing here. If there are any jets greater than PT cost. That calculates the pseudocode factor for you, just a probabilistic thing, and you get the same kind of cross-section. For the highest one, the rejection is slightly different. It's just reject if there are any jets greater than the highest jet that you have in the process. Because you do want to be able to describe when you have three hard jets, or three jets above PT cut. How would that ever get populated unless you allow this sample, where you start from two hard jets, to generate a slightly softer jet. You're still in the region that the shower can handle. It's generating a softer jet, at least. So you get some three jet events that have a bit three jets above PT cut. One of those jets, the softest of them, will then be in the shower approximation. That's the price you pay. Otherwise, you have to add a third exact jet and so forth. But there's a lot of rules to how you choose these PT cut values, and people are often doing horrible things with them because of the scale invariant structure of QCD, that to leading approximation, that's what you have to worry about. These things should be dominated by finite terms. They should not be dominated by logarithms for you to be allowed to play this game. That means if you have a Z prime with a mass of a TeV, you should not be using cut scales of 50 GeV or 100 GeV. You should be using something that's close to the high scale because that's what, you know, if you have a Z and you use a mass scale of 20 GeV to regulate these cross sections, and if you scale everything up, you should scale everything. That's what QCD tells you to do. So that's the rule. You use scale invariants to decide what these should be. You should actually not even express them as dimensional pool quantities. You should express them as ratios. That's what QCD wants. So people are starting to do that, but that took a long while. Anyway, there's a lot to calculate here, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. For instance, if I compute the matrix elements with one code and I do the shower with another code, it's very easy to break unitarity. Maybe two codes don't agree on what alpha S is. Maybe they don't even agree on what the running order for alpha S is. And so I start introducing spurious terms that violate this kind of unitarity probability conservation in all kinds of ways. And I'm generating uncontrolled terms. the shower off of these is off the B plus 1 matrix element, whereas the shower would actually have done it by transiting from a 2-parton, 2 or 3-parton state at some point. So I don't get exactly the same Sudarkov factor out of showering these. Even if I try to compute analytic Sudarkov factors, they're not exactly the same as what the shower generates, so there are spurious mismatches between them. It's a very delicate game, and there is a lot of industry and knowledge out there about how to do them correctly, but it's still, I find it somewhat unsatisfying. Also, just the structure of it is very much, none of these calculations benefit from each other. These are entirely separate, standalone calculations. This is being done entirely separate from that. And that's not how nature does it.
Go to plus 1, plus 2, and stop, or is that just the scheme?
No, you can go to whatever you want. This is just the scheme.
Yeah. As much as
you can calculate. But if you go to plus 4, then most of the time you're running out of steam. You can't. Your computer isn't big enough anymore. So, all right. So I want to change the paradigm. Instead of saying that you have a bunch of fixed order calculations that want to shower and combine, I want to change to this that you have the conformal or quasi-conformal structure that a shower already generates, and I want to correct that using the amplitudes, using the square or whatever you want. So can I interpret the shower as a primer for a more exact, a more precise evolution, and think of QCD really in terms of a differential equation? And the answer used to be no. It was done in the 80s already by Husband. So he used the shower in Pythia as a primer, and then instead of just using the shower kernels, he used the matrix element for the first emission. But as I mentioned, when you tried to expand that to higher orders, it very quickly got very complicated, and so they had to stop. Pauheg also uses this a little bit. They use the same trick for the real emission as Torbjörn did, and then they're also able to work out what the first loop expansion is and correct it. But again, the multi-leg generalization is we're still waiting for it. So that's what the aim with this Vincia thing that we're working on is to actually do that. And the A stands for antenna. That's what it's based on, and that's just, that gives you a couple of nice things. Antenna factorization gives you, for the amplitudes, you have factorization. These kinds of antenna patterns that I showed you, they're exact for both. They do both the soft and collinear. That's what's nice about them. I don't have to change my strategy when I go to soft and collinear. I can treat them on the same basis with antenna. So I have a smooth treatment that does both soft and collinear at the same time. It also is a nice phase-based factorization that's extremely clean. So it generates very simple expansions, and I can nest these phase spaces inside each other, and I never really have a problem with that. It's 2 on-shell partons to 3 on-shell with exact energy and momentum conservation. So I'm not violating anything. And then I can vary the evolution time and functions and so forth. So the reason this got complicated in the old days was if you start from 2 partons, I just pop 2 quarks out of the vacuum, now I want to evolve them and expand what they do. If I had an ordinary parton shower with, let's say, with helicity dependence, so I'm taking into account how many helicity configurations there are. Let's just normalize, so whatever the Born is 1. And then now I'm going to count how much happens for each emission that I can have. So I add a gluon emission, a normal shower that could come from there or there, and it could have 2 different helicities. So I would have 2 times 2 configurations to think about. I would also have, when I have 2 more, I would have 4 times 8, because now it could come from there or there or there or there, but in either of the 2 histories. So I'm starting to build up a factorial here. When I have 3 gluon emissions, they could come. You start to see the pattern. I start from this, I multiply it by 2, and I multiply it by n. So I start to have how many? 8 times 48, and so on. So I'm building up a structure here, which is 2 to the 2n n factorial. Now, OK, maybe I could do it for a couple of emissions, and I would still be able to work it out. But I certainly wouldn't want to go to very high multiplicities with this. So what do you get from these, from this kind of approach here? One thing that's crucial to it is also that we've defined it in a way that is truly Markovian. And I'll tell you what Markovian perturbation theory is. But Markovian just means history independent. We think of parton showers as Markov chains, but they aren't really the way they're normally defined, true Markov chains. There is a history dependent. Namely, how I shower this configuration should be unique if I'm Markovian. But a shower could have generated it either by this one being the last or that one being the last. That defines, so that defines the starting scale for the shower. I'll start at the scale of the last emission. But these have two different scales, so there are two different evolutions of this depending on which was the last emission. That's essentially why I get the n factorial. So if you do a Markovian shower that has no history dependence, so you just say, hand me a set of partons and I'll shower them in one way, the same way, always. Then you get rid of the n factorial. Then you do antennae instead of partons. So instead of having one term from here and one term from there, there's just one antenna. That gets rid of the 2 to the n. Then you do a helicity sampling by just treating a plus quark differently from a minus quark and treating a plus gluon differently from a minus gluon. So we just have more partons in there. Some of them are positive helicity, some of them are negative helicity. That gets rid of a 2 to the n. So let's start from this, and then you get down to n now. So I would have, and I'm going to, this is still not where I want to go, but I'll start there. That's called a global Markovian antenna shower. There's one term here because there's one antenna. There is two terms here because there are two antennae. There are three antennae, three terms, and so on. So it just grows with n, which is extremely simple. But we can get rid of that also. That's something called a sector shower, which is using something I've recently learned is also called the method of regions. I call it a sector decomposition of phase space. I only have one term. So this antenna now is responsible for populating one half of the total base space. I'll put all the singularities of this quark, all the singularities of that gluon in this antenna. And I'll also put all the singularities of this gluon and of that quark in this antenna. So normally, if I just allowed them, I would be double counting the singularities of this gluon, the collinear singularity of it, because I put all of it there and all of it there. But I'll draw a line in phase space and say, well, if the thing I've emitted looks softer with respect to this antenna, then it's that one's job, and the other one is vetoed, and the complementary. And so there really is, in every point in phase space, only one term that populates. So that's the sector Markov antenna shower, and it's one. And that's much nicer. So as you can really get to some very efficient structures. Also, this phase space generator that I now have, which I will now think of as a phase space generator, is building up a structure that already has all the leading singular structure of QCD. Sure. How I define the sector, the showers that I will build up from this will be slightly different, depending on all these choices that I make. So I can vary these in the same way as deform the sector boundaries a little bit, change finite terms again. I have to make some choices, but actually the choices I'm going to do is I'm going to make everything ridiculously large. So I'm going to choose very big finite terms. Everything is going to be very big, because if I have something that's an overestimate, in Monte Carlo I can use the veto algorithm to get down to the right answer, whatever it is. So I'm actually going to use a rather ridiculous shower to populate this. But what I rely on is that it gets exactly the right singular structures. So where a lot of gluons are being generated, I will be highly efficient. And then I will be somewhat inefficient for the small regions of phase space where I want to put in the quantum corrections. But there, I can't be sure that an ordinary shower would overcount the right answer. So I put something really big there. But I,
So I'm not so efficient in the hard regions of phase space, but I don't very often put any emission there because it's just not very likely. Most of the gluons are Bremsstrahlung gluons.
But in principle, what you're doing is you're trading computing time for more unphysical parameters. Can you say that again?
Well, but I'm going to get rid of them. So ultimately, what these other methods were doing, they were doing showering also, and those showers would have parameters. I have nothing different here in principle. I could use these as ordinary showers also. They generate bona fide approximations to QCD that look just like ordinary Parton showers. In fact, I can even make them better than ordinary Parton showers. So we have some tricks to improve them that we can get very good approximations to QCD up to very high legs with very small differences to exact matrix elements. And then it's just those small differences we want to put back in. And so we can generate quite good approximations. This, where you only have one term, gets a slightly worse approximation. It is better to have a sum over dipoles and allow each one to contribute a little bit. You get slightly better approximations with this, but you pay the price of having more terms. You still get a decent approximation with this. It's a little bit worse, but then you only have one term to worry about. These showers are also incredible. They have all kinds of properties, like they're uniquely invertible. If I ran a jet algorithm on this, there is, you know, at 20 partons, there is exactly one way through phase space that the shower went there. So I can invert the shower. I can do all kinds of crazy things. I can map jets. I can do NLO corrections in funny ways. Anyway, that's not what I'm going to do. So in order to wrap up, I'll show you how we do the corrections, the quantum corrections to this semi-classical shower. Every time I generate an emission, I have this differential equation that generates with it, and I have a kernel in that equation. I call that kernel a trial antenna. And I can make this something that's big, but it has the right singularity structures, but a very simple functional form, which means it's simple to make a random number generator that does this. So I generate trial branchings, and then I decide via the so-called veto algorithm whether I want to accept them or not. That's just a numerical trick, which is very useful. But this will then be transformed into, with some multiplicative factors, have to be less than one. Normally in a shower, I would simply say, well, it's the physical antenna, the shower antenna, instead of the trial antenna that I want to imprint. But I can put correction factors here. I can say, well, what about if I put n plus 1 parton matrix element divided by the sum of shower paths of n parton matrix elements. This denominator is exactly the p-level approximation that I would get from having an n parton state showered. This is the approximation of the shower to the n plus 1 matrix element. Well, this is the exact one. So once I sum over all the possible shower paths populating a certain phase space point, I'll generate the sum, you know, sum I here. This will cancel against that. That cancels there. And I'm left with the exact matrix element, leading order so far. But this is very simple. And you can even do it at full color. You can absorb full color into this as well. I won't show that because it would take too long. But if you're curious, ask me. This also works at full color. The next leading order, though, is the more funny part, which I've sketched here. So at the Born level, it's equivalent to what Pauheg does. At higher legs, the difference is we can keep on doing this for, in principle, as many legs as you want. But at some point, the scaling is still going to kill you a little bit. So I can compute at fixed order the exclusive two-jet rate, two and only two jets, two and only two partons, at a resolution scale of order the hadronization scale. That's something I can compute. I have chosen that variable to be what I will match. So that's the matrix element leading order plus the next leading order correction plus unresolved real. And I just call this ratio of the 3 and 2 parton matrix element, I just call that an antenna, which it is. So that's the parton shower antenna, which I'm using, just using the exact ratio here. Now, if I compute it, this is fixed order. Right? You know what this looks like. Leading order plus shower, if I've matched at tree level so that this really has that factor sitting there, what I would get is the Born level matrix element times the Sudarkov factor. Probability that I had no emission above the hadronization scale. That's this, 1 minus the exponent. Ooh, this is exactly the same integral. How nice. And it starts from that scale, and that's there, so I get the entire integral from 0 to mz squared. These two are exactly the same because of unitarity. So that's another reason why it's important not to break that. The next leading order correction, then I can take the difference between these two. Obviously, there is some difference. What is the matrix element? I've just written it with a singularity operator here that takes care of all the 1 over epsilon squared terms. You don't have to worry about that. And then there's some finite term. The integral over the real is this. When I add them together, I get exactly alpha s over pi, which is the correction to NLO to z decay. That's a trivial example, but that's just to show you how this works. That is exactly what Pauheg would have done. It would use radiation distributed with the correct matrix element. It would work out what the difference is between this and that integral and correct back with that factor. That's exactly what Pauheg does. In our case, we want to, for instance, do the 3-jet one. Well, I do exactly the same calculation. Fixed order, exclusive 3-jet rate, and now, since I don't really want this division of the integrals into one part here and one part there, I just say I imagine that I let the perturbative resolution scale go to infinity. But so I can do everything in D-dimension. These are equivalent. I could have done the same here. If I had set this to 0, I wouldn't have had that term there. I would only have this. There would be no contribution from the 3-jets. And this integral would go to 0 instead. They do exactly match, as long as I preserve unitarity. So this is easier. I can just write this down like that. What is the Schauer expansion of that? Well, I have 1 plus alpha s over pi from over there, times the Born-Hippel matrix element, times Sudakov factor, 3 parts on scale, emission, so this is the matrix element ratio, and then Sudakov factors here and here. This QQ bar and a QGQ bar Sudakov factor that goes the rest of the way. So I get these integrals here. And I'll just finish by showing you the result of that. Sorry that it took a little time, but I hope you've really gotten an understanding of how these things work and what the ambiguities are.
You've done the same thing as in Pauheg, I mean the same process. The difference would just be the choice of Q, basically.
Yes, so Pauheg, you could also start from this, but you couldn't start from 2 and then correct 3 and then correct 4. You only ever correct the first one in the Pauheg strategy as it's written. So the difference is that we can keep doing it. And we don't have a matching scale and all this stuff, which is annoying. So this is just to show you how this Markovian QCD solution works. You start from the Born level, you've calculated this exactly. You generate a trial emission. So I have an approximation now to m plus 1, which is just the sum over antennae times the Born. I can correct that to the matrix element by putting in this matrix element correction factor. And this has amazing properties, right? Because these are equal in all the singular limits, so it goes to unity in all the singular limits. And it's only outside there that I can get some deviation from unity. So it's a very well-behaved quantity. But now I have the right one there. By unitarity, I know that whatever I have here is minus the integral of that. And so I can correct that by working out what the difference is. Now that's correct as well. And then I can keep on going. I generate another emission. And correct that to the matrix element, I get something up there. And so this was sort of the state of the art. And this is what the 3-jet correction over there would be correcting. So the speed, and this was the question that was asked at some point, is there's two issues, right? How long from my press return do I have to wait till the thing actually starts generating events? And so that's initialization times. Here's seconds. This is just z decay matched to 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 legs. And if I use Sherpa and COMEX is a very fast, very good phase-based generator, but I still have to, in these slicing strategies where I have to compute the Born plus 1, Born plus 2 as separate calculations, I still have to start by computing what all those cross-sections are. I have to warm up the phase-based grids that I'm going to use for each of these phase-based generators for the Born plus 1, Born plus 2, and so forth. And that just takes more and more time. So this is a logarithmic scale. So in the end, you spend hours before you even start generating events. And as I said, I think you can change the slope of this by writing better algorithms.
But all I need to start in this Markovian approach is the Born-level matrix element and a Born-level generator, and it's very simple. The shower will generate all the rest of phase space for me. So I start at fractions of a second, no matter what happens. And then there's the time to generate events to actually do the showers and so forth. It's a little bit more difficult to do sector showers. They are the yellow ones, so it takes the actual shower algorithm, when I'm just doing pure showers, is slower. There are ways we might be able to optimize that, but what we were really interested in was the scaling. If I do the more traditional, what I call global showers, then all of these are, and Pythia is the same, you know, Pythia is maybe even a little bit faster, but pure showers, there's, we know how to write a pure shower in a way that's pretty optimized, and it takes a fraction of a millisecond to generate a shower. So you get 1,000 in a bit less than a second. And then when you start, you know, you have to add the 3-jet, 4-jet, 5-jet, 6-jet. If you slice phase space, but if you just do these Markovian corrections as you go along with no new phase space generators, then you can really get very flat behavior, depending on whether you do helicity sampling or not and all this stuff, you can get slightly different behaviors. But it has a much nicer behavior than the... I should also say that these are matched over all of phase space. They are matched even down into the very soft and collinear regions, because there the factors are just one. Whereas here, of course, you have this cut on below which you're not doing any correction. So that's something that's pretty encouraging, and we thought, well, maybe we can spend all this time difference calculating NLO corrections. And then, you know, you would have a generator that would generate NLO as fast as or faster than you used to be able to do LO. So this is the second order correction. This is what it looks like. But this is not scary, actually. It's very simple. This is alpha S over pi. That was the correction you had. So this is just the 3-jet. This is the correction difference. 3-jet matrix element, and this is what you subtract from it. This is the renormalization scale. Maybe I use a slightly different one. I use PT in the parton shower normally. But you can renormalize your matrix element at any scale you want. If you chose a different scale, just tell me what it is, and I'll put in this logarithm. So you can use different renormalization points. Typically, a matrix element will not have used exactly the same scale as in the shower, but I know exactly how, and it's just expanding alpha S. Then there are the singularity operators. So these are the integrated forms of the soft and collinear singularities that will cancel the corresponding ones in there. So if you tell me what your 1 over epsilon squared terms and 1 over epsilon, I'll cancel them against these. I get one from each antenna, and then some finite terms. And then there are these Surikov logarithms that I know how to calculate. These are cast in terms of standardized antenna functions. They're in the appendix of our paper. You calculate them once and for all, and then you just put them in. And they depend on the scale. So this depends on what your evolution variable choice is, which means this whole correction depends on what that choice is. And so these are from the 2 to 3, and these are from the 3 to 4 logarithms. This is something special. This is a trick that we use for gluon splitting. So when you have a gluon splitting into QQ bar, naive application of antennae as they're written down, these, you know, finding a quark inside a quark gluon antenna, so give a pretty horrible approximation to QCD, actually. It's not very good. In Ariadne, Leif Lundblad found that there was a trick you could do to say if you had a big dipole next to a small dipole, you can apply a little bit of suppression and enhancement in the small one. That gets you closer to the right answer in QCD. And by taking out as much of the mistakes we make, by getting closer to the right answer, the actual correction factors that we have to calculate numerically are smaller. So we try to do the best job we can analytically to get as many logarithms as we can out into the analytic answers, because they are much more stable. And the idea is that anything we have to compute, this is then the difference between the standardized antenna and the one that is actually matched to matrix elements. That we have to compute numerically, but they should be very flat. We don't want any logarithms. So we take out this logarithm just because we know it's there. But you can play with that. You could also start playing with subleading color structures here. This is only at leading color so far. Hello. This seems to have frozen. I was going to show you plot. Oh.
Anyway, this is not a particularly complicated calculation by any means. It's a standardized antenna subtracted matrix element. And but you don't even have to give us the subtracted matrix element. Just give us whatever it is. And we know what our subtraction terms are. And then the shower generates these additional terms that we can expand, and we know what they are. Aha. So this is just to say what the pseudocarb intervals are. This is a phase-based triangle where the evolution scale is going down towards the soft linear. But I want to end. So this is just to show that we can compute the delta A terms. The infrared limits are interesting because they are all proportional to the beta function. So that tells you can pick PT as a scale in for renormalization, and you will absorb these logs. That's beautiful. So here's a plot of the actual correction factors with the invariance on the axis. So this is just a three-jet system, quark, anti-quark, and a gluon. And these are the quark blue invariant, and this is the gluon anti-quark invariant. The logarithm of that divided by the Z mass scale. So you see logarithms go to minus 8. This is really very soft and very collinear region. And this is the hard resolved region when both of the invariants are large. That's hard three-jet emission. And this is the NLO correction factor that you get if you use a stupid choice of renormalization scale in the shower. You see that you get quite big corrections, 40% for hard emissions, and then it just grows as you go towards the soft region. And this is if you evolve in transverse momentum, all these things that we've discussed. There's a particular definition of lambda QCD. But you can also make smarter choices. This was the correction factor if I started by making pretty stupid choices. Now, correction to stupid is big. Correction to smart is not so big. So if I instead say I use PT as the renormalization scale, as I thought I should, the correction factors don't blow up anymore. So this is 1.75, 2, and there's a logarithm here that is just getting bigger and bigger. That logarithm can be absorbed, as I saw analytically by comparing the infrared limits. I saw that it was proportional to the beta function, and I can make a specific choice. The correction factor for infinitely soft emission is now 1. There is no everything. The shower does everything. The matrix, the next leading order matrix element correction factor is 1. But in the hard region, I still have some genuine NLO corrections of order 20%, which is fine. That's making the shower a little bit harder, as it should. And there are many other things you can do. You can say, well, what if I evolved in virtuality, dipole mass, and I get all these things where I can see that this dipole mass, it goes through phase space like this instead of like that. And so this one is precisely the one that does favor going directly to the soft region, whereas this one favors sort of going to the collinear region faster and staying away from the soft a little bit longer. This is actually the inverse of the Eichmann, so that's why that's a good evolution scale. So if I go to the soft first, I find that, oops, I went there too fast. The pseudocarb factor isn't suppressing enough, so the NLO correction responds by being a little bit lower than 1. And there is a runaway logarithm here that if I keep on going, the pseudocarb factor is sort of not doing enough suppression, and the NLO correction needs to correct that more and more and more. But if I'm here in the hard collinear region, the opposite is the case. I have a runaway positive logarithm that the pseudocarb factor is suppressing collinear emissions too much, and the NLO correction responds by trying to bring that up. Whereas in PT, I have nicely no runaway logs. So that's why we don't need a matching scale. There's no intrinsic cut here. You go smoothly to the soft collinear limits. Just keep applying the correction. And so this is the proof of footing. You can get good fits to event shapes, all this other stuff. We could do that already at leading order. But at leading order, we needed an alpha S value of 0.139, which is consistent with if you try to just squeeze it out of a leading order matrix element. Now at NLO, the proof of the footing was really that we can do it with a value of alpha S, that at least at NLO is consistent with other extractions. And so this should be more universal. You can use it with NLO corrected showers in other contexts and so forth.
And of course, the expectation is that if you were able to go to N and LO, you would see probably a further reduction, but we don't know that yet. But this is, at least for me, that was like, at the end of all this work, that was what I wanted to see. It's still a little bit high, but okay, that's what comes out of fitting all the event shapes, all the, you know, down to Y56. We're looking at not just three jet observables. The Monte Carlo should describe everything. So some of this, and maybe because of missing NLO corrections on the four jet rate, this still wants to be a little bit high, but that's what came out of it. Okay. I think, well, good.